laborious and ultimately unrewarding task of working out which suspects and witnesses were represented by each astrological glyph had been far from his favourite bit of research. "Well," said Robin, taking out two folded photocopies, which she'd been keeping in the notebook, "I've been wondering. Look at these." She passed the two documents to Strike, who opened them and saw copies of two birth certificates, one for Olive Satchwell, the other for Blanche Satchwell. "Olive was Satchwell's mother," said Robin, as Strike, smoking, examined the documents, "and Blanche was his sister, who died aged 10, possibly with a pillow over her face."
"If you're expecting me to deduce their star signs from these birthdays," said Strike, "I haven't memorized the whole zodiac."
"Blanche was born on the 25th of October, which makes her a Scorpio," said Robin. "Olive was born on the 29th of March. Under the traditional system, she'd be Aries, like Satchwell." To Strike's surprise, Robin now took out a copy of Astrology 14 by Stephen Schmidt. "It was quite hard to track this down. It's been out of print for ages."
"A masterwork like that, you amaze me," said Strike, watching Robin turn to a page listing the dates of revised signs, according to Schmidt.
Robin smiled, but refusing to be deflected, said, "Look here. By Schmidt's system, Satchwell's mother was a Pisces."
"We're mixing up the two systems now, are we?" asked Strike.
"Well, Talbot did," Robin pointed out. "He decided Irene and Roy should be given their Schmidt signs, but other people were allowed to keep the traditional ones."
"But," said Strike, well aware that he was trying to impose logic on what was essentially illogical, "Talbot made massive sweeping assumptions on the basis of people's original signs. Brenner was ruled out as a suspect solely because he was..."
"Libra, yes," said Robin.
"Well, what happens to Janice being psychic and the Essex Butcher being a Capricorn, if all the dates started sliding around?"
"Wherever there was a discrepancy between the traditional sign and Schmidt sign, he seems to have gone with a sign he thought suited the person best."
"Which makes a mockery of the whole business. And also," said Strike, "calls all my identifications of signs and suspects into question."
"I know," said Robin. "Even Talbot seems to have got very stressed trying to work across both systems, which is when he began concentrating mainly on asteroids in the tarot."
"Okay," said Strike, blowing smoke away from her. "Go on with what you were saying. If Satchwell's sister was a Scorpio and her mother was Pisces, remind me," said Strike, "exactly what that passage about Scorpio says."
Robin flipped backwards through Talbot's notebook until she found the passage decorated with doodles of the crab, the fish, the scorpion, the fish-tailed goat, and the water-bearer's urn. "Aquarius worried about how Scorpio died?" she read aloud. And, written in capitals, "Schmidt agrees with Adams." Then, "Did Aquarius challenge Pisces about Scorpio? Was Cancer there? Did Cancer witness? Cancer is kind, instinct is to protect." Then, in capitals, "Interview again. Scorpio and Aquarius connected, water, water, also Cancer and Capricorn." In capitals, "has a fish's tail."
Brow furrowed, Strike said, "We're assuming Cancer still means Janice, right?"
"Well, Janice and Cynthia are the only two Cancerians connected with the case, and Janice seems to fit this better," said Robin. "Let's say Margot decided she was going to act on her suspicion that Satchwell's mother killed his sister. If she phoned Olive from the surgery, Janice might have overheard a phone call, mightn't she? And if Janice knew the Satchwell family and was involved with them in some way we don't know about, she mightn't have wanted to tell the police what she'd overheard for fear of incriminating Olive."
"Why would Margot have waited years to check out her suspicions about the pillow dream?" asked Strike.
But before Robin could supply an answer, he did it himself.
"Of course, people do sometimes take years to decide what action to take on something like that, or to muster up the courage to do it."
He handed Robin back the two photocopies.
"Well, if that's the story behind the Scorpio business, Satchwell's still a prime suspect."
"I never got his address in Greece," said Robin guiltily.
"We'll get at him through his surviving sister if we have to."
Strike took a swig of coffee, then, slightly against his better judgment, asked,
"What did you say about asteroids?"
Robin flicked further on through the notebook,
to show Strike the page she'd pored over in Leamington Spa, which she thought of as the Horns page. As the case went on, he seemed to give up on normal astrology. I think Schmidt had confused him so much he couldn't work it anymore, so he starts inventing his own system. He's calculated the asteroid's position for the evening Margot disappeared. See here. Robin was pointing to the symbol. That symbol stands for the asteroid Pallas Athena. Remember that ugly clock at the Phipps' house? And he's using it to mean Margot. The asteroid Pallas Athena was in the 10th house of the zodiac on the night Margot disappeared, and the 10th house is ruled by Capricorn. It's also supposed to govern business, upper classes, and upper floors.
You think Margot's still in some attic?
Robin smiled, but refused to be deflected. And see here. She angled the notebook towards him. Assuming the other asteroids also refer to living people, we've got Ceres, Juno, and Vesta. I think he's using Vesta, keeper of the hearth, to represent Cynthia. Vesta was in the 7th house, which is the house of marriage. Talbot's written, Fitz. So I think he's saying Cynthia was in Margot's marital home, Broom House. I think nurturing, protective Ceres sounds like Janice again. She's in the 12th house, and so's Juno, who's associated with wives and infidelity, which might take us back to Joanna Hammond, Douthwaite's married girlfriend.
What's the 12th house represent?
Enemies, secrets, sorrows and undoing. Strike looked at her, eyebrows raised. He'd indulged Robin because it was sunny and he was enjoying her company, but his tolerance for astrology was now wearing very thin. It's also Pisces' house, said Robin, which is Douthwaite's sign. So maybe
you think Janice and Joanna Hammond were both in Douthwaite's flat when Margot was abducted, do you?
No, but because that'd be tricky, give that Joanna Hammond died weeks before Margot disappeared.
Or are you suggesting her ghost was haunting Douthwaite?
All right, I know it might mean nothing, said Robin, half laughing, as she ploughed on. But Talbot's written something else here. Ceres denies contact with Juno. Could Cetus be right? She was pointing at the whale symbol representing Irene.
I find it hard to imagine Irene Hickson being right about very much, said Strike.
He pulled the leather notebook towards him to look more closely at Talbot's small, obsessive writing, then pushed the notes away again with a slightly impatient shrug.
Look, it's easy to get sucked into this stuff. When I was going through the notes, I started making connections while I was trying to follow his train of thought. But he was ill, wasn't he? Nothing leads anywhere concrete.
I was just intrigued by that. Could Cetus be right? Because Talbot mistrusted Irene from the start, didn't he? Then he starts wondering whether she could have been right about something connected to enemies, secrets and undoing.
If we ever find out what happened to Margot Bamborough, said Strike, I'll bet you £100 you'll be able to make equally strong cases for Talbot's occult stuff being bang on the money and completely off beam. You can always stretch this symbolic stuff to fit the facts. One of my mother's friends used to guess everyone's star signs, and she was right. Every single time.
She was?
Oh, yeah, said Strike. Because even when she was wrong, she was right. Turned out they had a load of planets in that sign, or, I don't know, the midwife who delivered them was that sign, or their dog.
All right, said Robin, equably.
She'd expected Strike's scepticism after all, and now put both the leather-bound notebook and Astrology 14 back into her bag.
I know it might mean nothing at all. I'm only...
If you want to go and see Irene Hickson again, be my guest. Tell her Talbot thought she might have had profound insight into something connected to asteroids and, I don't know, cheese.
The 12th house doesn't govern cheese, said Robin, trying to look severe.
What number's the house of dairy?
Oh, bugger off, she said, laughing against her will.
Robin's mobile vibrated in her pocket, and she pulled it out. A text had just arrived. Hi, Robin. If you want, I can talk now. I've just agreed to work a later shift, so I'm not needed at work for a few hours. Otherwise, it'll have to be after 8 tonight. Amanda.
Amanda White, she told Strike. She wants to talk now.
Works for me, said Strike, relieved to be back on firm investigative ground.
Liar or not, Amanda White would at least be talking about an actual woman at a real window. Robin pressed Amanda's number, switched the mobile to speakerphone, and laid it on the table between her and Strike.
"Hi,"
said a confident female voice, with a hint of North London.
"Is that Robin?"
"Yes," said Robin. "And I'm with Cormoran."
"Morning," said Strike.
"Oh, it's you, is it?"
said Amanda, sounding delighted.
"I am honoured. I've been dealing with your assistant."
"She's actually my partner," said Strike.
"Really? Business or the other?"
said Amanda.
"Business," said Strike, not looking at Robin. "I understand Robin's been talking to you about what you saw on the night Margot Bamber had disappeared."
"That's right,"
said Amanda.
"Would you mind if we take a recording of this interview?"
"No, I suppose not," said Amanda. "I mean, I want to do the right thing, although I won't pretend it hasn't been a bit of a dilemma, because it was really stressful last time. Journalists, 2 police interviews, and I was only 14. But I've always been a stubborn girl, and I stuck to me guns."
So Amanda told the story, with which Strike and Robin were already familiar, of the rain and the angry school friend and the upper window and the retrospective recognition of Margot when Amanda saw her picture in the paper. Strike asked a couple of questions, but he could tell that nothing would ever change Amanda's story. Whether she truly believed she'd seen Margot Bamber at the window that night or not, she was evidently determined never to relinquish her association with the 40-year-old mystery.
"And I suppose I've been haunted ever since by the idea that I didn't do anything. But I was 14 and it only hit me later. I could have been the one to save her."
She ended the story.
"Well,"
said Robin, as Strike nodded at her, signalling he had everything he wanted.
"Thank you so much for talking to us, Amanda. I really... There's something else before you go,"
said Amanda.
"Wait until you hear this. It's just an amazing coincidence, and I don't think even the police know about this, because they're both dead."
"Who are dead?" asked Robin, while Strike lit himself another cigarette.
"Well," said Amanda, "how's this for strange? My last job, this young girl at the office's great aunt,"
Strike rolled his eyes,
"was in a hospice with, guess who?"
"I don't know," said Robin politely.
"Violet Cooper," said Amanda. "You probably don't..."
"Dennis Creed's landlady," said Robin.
"Exactly,"
said Amanda, sounding pleased that Robin appreciated the significance of her story.
"So anyway, isn't that just weird, that I saw Margot at that window, and then, all those years later, I worked with someone whose relative met Vi Cooper? Only she was calling herself something different by then because people hated her."
"That is a coincidence," said Robin, making sure not to look at Strike.
"Well, thank... That's not all," said Amanda, laughing. "No, there's more to it than that. So, this girl's great-aunt said Vi told her she wrote to Creed once, asking if he'd killed Margot Bamberer."
Amanda paused, clearly wanting a response. So Robin, who'd already read about this in The Demon of Paradise Park, said,
"Wow." "I know," said Amanda. "And apparently Vi said... This is on her deathbed, so, you know, she was telling the truth, because you would, wouldn't you? Vi said the letter she got back said he had killed her."
"Really?" said Robin.
"I thought the letter... No, but this is direct from Violet," Amanda said,
while Strike rolled his eyes again.
"And she said he definitely did. He as good as told her so. He said it in a way only she'd understand, but she knew exactly what he meant." "Crazy, though, isn't it? I see Margot at the window, and then, years later..."
"Amazing," said Robin. "Well, thanks very much for your time, Amanda. This has been really, It took Robin another couple of minutes, and much more insincere gratitude, to get Amanda off the line. "What do you think?" Robin asked Strike, when at last she'd succeeded in getting rid of Amanda. He pointed a finger at the sky.
"What?"
said Robin, looking up into the blue haze.
"If you look carefully," said Strike, "you might just see an asteroid passing through the House of Bollocks."
Chapter 50
"Ay me," said she, "where am I, or with whom? Among the living, or among the dead?"
Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. Agency work unconnected with the Bamberer case consumed Strike for the next few days. His first attempt to surprise Nurse Janice Beattie at home was fruitless. He left Nightingale Grove, a nondescript street that lay hard against the southeastern railway line, without receiving any answer to his knock. His second attempt, on the following Wednesday, was made on a breezy afternoon that kept threatening showers. Strike approached Janice's house from Hither Green Station, along a pavement bordered to the right with railings and hedge, separating the road from the rail tracks. He was thinking about Robin as he trudged along, smoking, because she'd just turned down the opportunity of joining him to interview Janice, saying that there was something else she needed to do, but not specifying what that something was. Strike thought he'd detected a trace of caginess, almost amounting to defensiveness, in Robin's response to the suggestion of a joint interview, where usually there'd have been only disappointment. Since she'd left Matthew, Strike had become used to more ease and openness between him and Robin, so this refusal, coupled with her tone and lack of an explanation, made him curious. While there were natural matters he might not have expected her to tell him about, trips to the gynecologist sprang to mind. He would have expected her to say, "I've got a doctor's appointment, at least." The sky darkened as Strike approached Janice's house, which was considerably smaller than Irene Hickson's. It stood in a terrace. Net curtains hung at all the windows, and the front door was dark red. Strike didn't immediately register the fact that a light was shining from behind the net curtains at the sitting room window until he was halfway across the road. When he realized that his quarry must be in, however, he successfully pushed all thoughts about his business partner out of his mind, crossed the road at a quicker pace, and knocked firmly on the front door. As he stood waiting, he heard the muffled sounds of a TV on high volume through the glass of the downstairs window. He was just considering knocking again, in case Janice hadn't heard the first time, when the door opened. In contrast to the last time they'd met, the nurse, who was wearing steel-rimmed spectacles, looked shocked and none too pleased to see Strike. From behind her, two female American voices rang out from the out-of-sight TV.
"So you love the bling? I love the bling." "Have I missed a message, or—"
"Sorry for the lack of warning," said Strike, insincerely. "But as I was in the area, I wondered whether you could give me a couple of minutes."
Janice glanced back over her shoulder. A camp male voice was now saying,
"The dress that Kelly is in love with is a one-of-a-kind runway sample."
Clearly disgruntled, Janice turned back to Strike.
"Well, all right," she said, "but the place is in a mess. And can you please wipe your feet properly, because the last bloke who turned up here unannounced brought dog shit in with him. You can close the door behind you."
Strike stepped over the threshold, while Janice strode out of sight into the sitting room. Strike expected her to turn off the TV, but she didn't. While Strike wiped his feet on the coconut mat inside the door, a male voice said,
"This one-of-a-kind runway gown might be impossible to find, so Randy's on the search."
After hesitating for a moment on the doormat, Strike decided that Janice expected him to follow her, and entered the small sitting room. Having spent a significant part of his youth in squats with his mother, Strike had a very different idea of mess to Janice's. Although cluttered, with something on almost every surface, the only signs of actual disorder in the room were a copy of the Daily Mirror lying in one armchair, some crumpled packaging lying beside an open packet of dates on the low coffee table, and a hairdryer, which was lying incongruously on the floor beside the sofa, and which Janice was currently unplugging.
"Antonella's pulling the closet gown to Kelly's pick, a blinged-out $15,000 dress." "The mirror down here's better for drying my hair," Janice explained, straightening up, pink in the face, hairdryer in her hand, and looking slightly cross, as though Strike was forcing her to justify herself. "I would have appreciated some warning, you know," she added, looking as stern as such a naturally smiley-looking woman could. "You've caught me on the op."
Strike was unexpectedly and poignantly reminded of Joan, who'd always been flustered if guests dropped in while the Hoover or the ironing board was still out.
"Sorry. As I say, I happen to be in the area."
"Even as Kelly steps into dress number one, she still can't get her dream dress off her mind,"
said the narrator loudly. And both Strike and Janice glanced towards the TV, where a young woman was wriggling into a clinging, semi-transparent white dress covered in silver rhinestones.
Say yes to the dress,
said Janice, who was wearing the same navy jumper and slacks as the last time Strike had seen her.
My guilty pleasure. Do you want a cup of tea?
Only if it's no trouble, said Strike.
Well, it's always some trouble, innit?
Janice said, with her first glimmer of a smile.
But I was going to make myself some at the first advert break, so you might as well have some.
In that case, thanks very much, said Strike.
If I don't find this dress,
said the camp male wedding consultant on screen, rifling urgently through the racks of white dresses, his eyebrows so sharply plucked they looked drawn on.
It's not going to be...
The screen went blank. Janice had turned it off with her remote control.
Want a date?
She asked Strike, holding out the box. No thanks, said Strike.
Got boxes of them in Dubai, she said. I was going to give them as presents, but I just can't stop eating them. Have a seat. I won't be two ticks.
Strike thought he caught another downward glance towards his lower legs as she marched out of the room, hairdryer in one hand, dates in the other, leaving Strike to take an armchair, which creaked beneath his weight. Strike found the small sitting room oppressive. Predominantly red, the carpet was decorated in a scarlet swirling pattern, on top of which lay a cheap crimson Turkish rug. Dried flower pictures hung on the red walls between old photographs, some black and white, and the coloured ones faded, displayed in wooden frames. A china cabinet was full of cheap spun glass ornaments. The largest, a Cinderella carriage pulled by six glass horses, stood in pride of place on the mantelpiece over the electric fire. Evidently, beneath Janice's no-nonsense clothing, there beat a romantic heart. She returned a few minutes later, holding a wicker-handled tray, bearing two mugs of tea with the milk already added, and a plate of chocolate hobnobs. The act of making tea seemed to have put her into slightly better humour with her guest.
"That's my Larry,"
she said, catching Strike looking towards a double frame on the small side table beside him. On one side was a sleepy-eyed, overweight man with smoker's teeth. On the other was a blonde woman, heavy, but pretty.
"Ah, and is this—"
"My little sister Claire. She died, 97. Pancreatic cancer. They got it late."
"Oh, I'm sorry to hear that," said Strike.
"Yeah," said Janice, with a deep sigh. "Lost them both around the same time. To tell you the truth," she said, as she sat down on the sofa and her knees gave audible clicks, "I walked back in here after Dubai and I thought, I really need to get some new pictures up. It was depressing, coming back in here, the number of dead people. I got some gorgeous ones of Kev and the grandkids on holiday, but I haven't got them printed out yet. The lad next door's going to do it for me. All my old ones of Kev and the kids are 2 years out of date. I gave the boy the memory... board, is it?"
"Card?"
"Card," suggested Strike. "That's the one. The kids next door just laugh at me. Mind you, Irene's worse than I am. She can hardly change a battery." "So," she said, "why do you want to see me again?"
Strike, who had no intention of risking an immediate rebuff, was planning to ask his questions about Satchwell last. Drawing out his notebook and opening it, he said,
"A couple of things that have come up since I last saw you. I asked Dr. Gupta about this first one, but he couldn't help, so I hoped you might be able to. Would you happen to know anything about a man called Niccolo Ricci, sometimes nicknamed Mucky?"
"Old gangster, weren't he?" said Janice. "I knew he lived local in Clerkenwell, but I never met him. Why do you want—" "Oh, has Irene been telling you about the foundations thing?"
"The what?" said Strike.
"Oh, it's nothing really. There was this rumour, back when they were doing a load of redevelopment round Clerkenwell in the early 70s, that some builders had found a body buried in concrete under one of the demolished buildings. The story was that Little Italy gangsters had hidden it there, back in the 40s. But Eddie, this is Irene's Eddie, the builder she ended up marrying, that's how they met, local pub, when his firm was doing a lot of the redevelopment. Eddie told us it was all cobblers. I hadn't ever believed it. I think Irene had a bit," Janice added, dunking a biscuit in her tea.
"How does this tie in with Margot?" Strike asked.
"Well, after Margot disappeared, there was a theory her body had been put into one of the open foundations and covered in concrete.
They were still doing a bit of building round there in 74, see?
Were people suggesting Ritchie had killed her? Asked Strike.
God, no, said Janice, with a shocked little laugh. What would Mucky Ritchie have to do with Margot? It was only because of that old rumour. It put the idea in people's minds, you know, burying bodies in concrete. People can be bloody silly. My Larry said to me, he was a builder, you know. It's not like workmen wouldn't have noticed a load of fresh concrete when they turned up for work.
Were you aware that Ritchie attended the St. John's Practice Christmas party?
He what?
Said Janice, with her mouth full.
He and another couple of men arrived towards the end of the party, possibly to escort Gloria home.
They? What?
Janice said, looking unaffectedly astonished.
Mucky Ritchie and Gloria?
Come off it.
Is this because... No, look, you don't want to pay no attention to Irene. Not about Gloria. Irene, she gets carried away. She never much liked Gloria. And she gets the wrong end of the stick sometimes. I never heard Gloria's family had any criminal connections.
Irene watched way too many Godfather movies, said Janice.
We saw the first one together at the cinema. And I went back and saw it again twice more on me own. James Caan, you know, she sighed. My dream man.
Ritchie was definitely at the practice party, said Strike. From what I can tell, he turned up right at the end.
Well, then, I'd already left. I needed to get home to Kev. Is he still alive, Ritchie?
Yes, said Strike.
Must be really getting on, is he?
He is, said Strike.
That's odd, though. What on earth would Ritchie be doing at St. John's?
I'm hoping to find out, said Strike, flipping over a page of his notebook. The next thing I wanted to ask you was about Joseph Brenner. You remember the family you thought might be called Applethorpe? Well, I found...
You never tracked them down, said Janice, looking impressed. What was their name?
Athorn.
Athorn, said Janice, with an air of relief. I knew it wasn't Applethorpe. That bugged me for days after. How are they? It's Fragile X they've got, isn't it? They're not in an home or...
Still living together in the old flat, said Strike. And getting on reasonably well, I think.
I hope they're being well supported. Are they?
There is a social worker involved, who seems very much on their side. Which brings me to what I was going to ask you. The social worker said that since Gwilhelm's death, Deborah's disclosed...
Strike hesitated.
Well, the way the social worker put it was that Gwilhelm was, pimping Deborah out.
He was what?
Said Janice, the smile sliding off her face.
It's an unpleasant idea, I know, said Strike, unemotionally. When I was talking to her, Deborah told me about Dr. Brenner visiting her at home. She said he'd, asked her to take her pants off.
No!
Said Janice, in what seemed instinctive revulsion.
No, I'm sure. No, that's not right. That's not how it would have happened, if she needed an intimate examination. It would have happened at the surgery.
You said she was agoraphobic.
Well, yeah, but...
So and the son said something about Dr. Brenner being a dirty old man.
He... But, no, it must have been an examination. Maybe after the baby was born. But that should have been me, the nurse. That's upset me now, said Janice, looking distressed. You think you've heard everything, but... No, that's really upset me. I mean, I was in the house that one time to see the kid, and she never said a word to me. But, of course, he was there, the father, telling me all about his bloody magic powers. She was probably too scared to... No, that's really upset me, that has.
I'm sorry, said Strike, but I have to ask... Did you ever hear that Brenner used prostitutes? Ever hear any rumours about him locally?
Not a word, said Janice. I'd have told someone if I'd heard that. It wouldn't be ethical, not in our catchment area. All the women there were registered to our practice. She'd have been a patient.
According to Talbot's notes, said Strike, somebody claimed they saw Brenner in Michael Cliff House on the evening Margot disappeared. The story Brenner gave the police was that he went straight home.
"Michael Cliff House. That's the tower block on Skinner Street, innit?" said Janice. "We had patients in there, but otherwise—"
Janice appeared sickened.
"You've upset me," she said again. "Him and that poor Athorn woman. And there's me defending him to all and sundry because of his experiences in the war. Not 2 weeks back I had Dorothy's son sitting exactly where you are now."
"Carl Oakden was here," said Strike sharply.
"Yeah," said Janice. "And he didn't wipe his feet neither. Dog shit all up my old carpet."
"What did he want?" asked Strike.
"Well, he pretended it was a nice catch-up," said Janice. "You'd think I might not recognise him after all this time, but actually, he don't look that much different. Not really. Anyway, he sat in that chair where you are, spouting all sorts of rubbish about old times and his mum remembering me fondly. Ha! Dorothy Oakden, remember me fondly. Dorothy thought Irene and me were a pair of hussies, skirts above our knees, going out to the pub together." "He mentioned you," said Janice, with a beady look. "Wanted to know if I'd met you yet. He wrote a book about Margot, you know, but he never made it into the shops, which he's angry about. He told me all about it when he was here. He's thinking of writing another one, and it's you what's got him interested in it. The famous detective solving a case, or the famous detective not solving the case. Either one will do for Carl."
"What was he saying about Brenner?" asked Strike. There would be time enough later to consider the implications of an amateur biographer tramping all over the case.
"Said Dr. Brenner was a sadistic old man, and there I was, sort of sticking up for Dr. Brenner. But now you're telling me this about Deborah Athorn."
"Oakden said Brenner was sadistic, did he? That's a strong word."
"I thought so too. Carl said he'd never liked him. Said Dr. Brenner used to go round Dorothy's house a lot, which I never realised, for Sunday lunch and that. I always thought they were just workmates. You know, Dr. Brenner probably told Carl off, that's all. He was an holy terror when he was a kid, Carl, and he comes across as the kind of man who holds a grudge."
"If Oakden comes round here again," said Strike, "I'd advise you not to let him in. He'd done time, you know, for cunning..." He just stopped himself saying "old." "Single women out of their money."
"Oh," said Janice, taken aback. "Blimey, I better warn Irene. He said he was going to try her next."
"And he seemed primarily interested in Brenner, did he, when he came round here?"
"Well, no," said Janice. "He seemed mostly interested in you, but yeah, we talked about Brenner more than anyone else at the practice."
"Mrs. Beattie, you wouldn't happen to still have that newspaper obituary of Brenner you mentioned. I think you said you kept it."
"Oh,"
said Janice, glancing towards the drawer at the base of her china cabinet.
"Yeah, Carl wanted to see that too when he heard I had it."
She pushed herself out of the sofa and crossed to the china cabinet. Gripping the mantelpiece to steady herself, she knelt down, opened the drawer, and began rummaging.
"They're all in a bit of a state, my clippings. Irene thinks I'm bonkers, me and my newspapers," she added,
wrist deep in the contents of the drawer.
"She's never been much for the news or politics or any of that. But I've always saved interesting bits and pieces, you know. Medical things. And I won't lie, I do like a story on the royals and..."
She began tugging on what looked like the corner of a cardboard folder.
"And Irene can think it strange all she likes, but I don't see what's wrong with saving the story of..."
The folder came free.
"A life,"
said Janice, walking on her knees to the coffee table.
"Why is that morbid? No worse than keeping a photo."
She flipped open the folder and began looking through the clippings, some of them yellow with age.
"See? I saved that for her, for Irene," said Janice,
holding up an article about Holy Basil.
"Supposed to help with digestive problems. I thought Eddie could plant some in the garden for her. She takes too many pills for her bowels. They do as much harm as good. But Irene's one of those who, if it doesn't come in a tablet, she don't want to know." "Princess Diana,"
said Janice with a sigh, flashing a commemorative front page at Strike.
"I was a fan."
"May I?" asked Strike,
reaching for a couple of pieces of newsprint.
"Help yourself,"
said Janice, looking over her spectacles at the pieces of paper in Strike's hand.
"That article on diabetes is very interesting. Care's changed so much since I retired. My godson's type 1. I like to keep up with it all. And that'll be the thing about the kid who died of peritonitis in your other hand, is it?
Yes, said Strike, looking at the clipping, which was brown with age.
Yeah, said Janice darkly, still turning over bits of newspaper. He's the reason I'm a nurse. That's what put the idea in me head. He lived two doors down from me when I was a kid. I cut that out and kept it. Only photo I was ever going to have. Bawled me bloody eyes out. The doctor, said Janice, with a hint of steel, was called out, and he never bloody turned up. He would have come out for a middle-class kid, we all knew that. But little Johnny Marks from Bethnal Green, who cared? And the doctor was criticised, but never struck off. If there's one thing I hate, it's treating people different because of where they were born.
With no apparent sense of irony, she shifted more pictures of the royals out of the way, looking puzzled.
"Where's Dr. Brenner's thing?" she muttered.
Still clutching several clippings, she walked on her knees back towards the open drawer and rummaged in there again.
"No, it really isn't here," said Janice,
returning to the coffee table.
"That's very odd."
"You don't think Oakden took it, do you?" Strike suggested.
Janice looked up.
"That cheeky sod," she said slowly. "He could have bloody asked."
She swept her clippings back into their folder, returned it to her drawer, used the mantelpiece to pull herself back up, knees clicking loudly again, then sat back down on the sofa with a sigh of relief and said,
"You know, he was always light-fingered, that boy."
"What makes you say that?"
"Money went missing back at the practice."
"Really?" said Strike.
"Yeah. It all come to an head after Margot disappeared. Little bits of money kept going missing, and they thought it was Wilma, the cleaner. Everyone except me. I always thought it was Carl. He used to drop in after school and in the school holidays. I dropped a word in Dr. Gupta's ear, but I don't know. Probably he didn't want to upset Dorothy, and it was easier to push Wilma out. True, there were other issues with Wilma. She drank," said Janice, "and her cleaning wasn't the best. She couldn't prove she never nicked it, and after there was a staff meeting about it, she resigned. She could see the way it was going."
"And did the theft stop?"
"Yeah," said Janice. "But so what? Carl might have thought he'd better give it a rest after nearly being found out."
Strike, who tended to agree, said,
"Just a couple more questions. The first's about a woman called Joanna Hammond."
"I should know who that is, should I?"
"She was Steve Douthwaite's
girlfriend who killed herself," said Janice. "Oh, yeah."
"Can you remember whether she was registered with the St. John's practice?"
"No, she weren't. I think they lived over in Hoxton."
"So Margot wouldn't have been involved with the coroner or had any other professional connection with her death?"
"No. She'll have been the same as me. Never knew the woman existed till she was already dead, and Steve come looking for help. I bet I know why you're asking, though," said Janice. "Talbot was dead set on Steve being the Essex butcher, wasn't he? On and on about Steve and all those interviews I had with him. But honestly, Steve Douthwaite was a gentle soul. I grew up with a couple of proper violent men. Me father was one. I know the type, and Steve definitely weren't it."
Remembering how endearing some women had found the apparent vulnerability of Dennis Creed, Strike merely nodded.
"Talbot asked whether I'd ever visited that Joanna as a nurse. I told him she wasn't a St. John's patient, but that didn't put him off. Did I think there was anything fishy about her death even so? I kept saying, I never met the woman. How do I know? I was getting worn down with it all by then, honestly, being treated like I was Gypsy Bloody Rose Lee. I told Talbot, go see what the coroner said."
"And you don't know whether there was a death Margot worried about?" Strike asked. "A death that was maybe categorised as natural or accidental, but where she thought there might have been foul play?"
"What makes you ask that?" said Janice.
"Just trying to clear up something Talbot left in his notes. He seemed to think Margot might have had suspicions about the way somebody died. You were mentioned in connection with the death."
Janice's round blue eyes widened behind her glasses.
"Mentioned as having witnessed something or perhaps been present," Strike elaborated. "There was no hint of accusation."
"I should bloody well hope not,"
said Janice.
No, I never witnessed nothing. I'd have said if I had, wouldn't I?
There was a short pause, which Strike judged it prudent not to break. And sure enough, Janice piped up again.
Look, I can't speak for Margot 40 years on. She's gone, isn't she? It isn't fair on either of us. I don't want to be cast in suspicion round all these years later.
I'm just trying to eliminate possible lines of inquiry, said Strike.
There was a longer pause. Janice's eyes drifted over the tea tray and onto the picture of her late partner, with his stained teeth and his kind, sleepy eyes. Finally, she sighed and said,
All right. But I want you to write down that this was Margot's idea, not mine, all right? I'm not accusing no one.
Fair enough, said Strike, pen poised over his notebook.
All right, then, well, it was very sensitive because of us working with Dorothy, I mean. Dorothy and Carl live with Dorothy's mother. Her name was Maud, though I wouldn't remember that if Carl hadn't been here the other day. We were talking and I mentioned his gran and he called her Bloody Maud, not Grandma or nothing. Anyway, Maud had an infection on her leg, a sore that was taking its time healing. It needed dressing and looking after, so I was visiting the house a lot. Every time I was in there, she told me she owned the house, not Dorothy. She was letting her daughter and grandson live with her. She liked saying it, you know, feeling the power. I wouldn't say she'd be much fun to live with. Sour old lady. Nothing ever right for her. She moaned a lot about her grandson being spoiled. But like I said, he was an only terror when he was younger, so I can't blame her there. Anyway, said Janice, before the sore on her leg was healed, she died after falling downstairs. Now, her walking wasn't great because she'd been laid up for a bit with this sore leg and she needed a stick. People do fall downstairs, and if you're elderly, obviously that can have serious consequences, but... Well, a week afterwards, Margot asked me into her consulting room for a word, and... Well, yeah, I got the impression Margot was maybe a bit uneasy about it. She never said anything outright, just asked me what I thought. I knew what she was saying, but what could we do? We weren't there when she fell, and the family said they was downstairs and just heard her take the tumble. And there she was at the bottom of the stairs, knocked out cold, and she died 2 nights later in hospital. Dorothy never showed no emotion about it. But Dorothy never did show much emotion about anything. What could we do?
Janice repeated, her palms turned upwards.
Obviously, I could see the way Margot's mind was working, because she knew Maud owned the house. And now Dorothy and Carl were sitting pretty and... Well, it's the kind of thing doctors consider. Of course they do. It would come back on them if they missed anything. But in the end, Margot never done nothing about it. And as far as I know, there was never any bother.
There, Janice concluded, with a slight air of relief at having got this off her chest.
Now you know.
Thank you, said Strike, making a note. That's very helpful.
Tell me, did you ever mention this to Talbot? No, said Janice, but someone else might have done. Everyone knew Maud had died and how she died, because Dorothy took a day off for the funeral. I'll be honest, by the end of all my interviews with Talbot, I just wanted to get out of there. Mostly, he wanted me to talk about me dreams. It was creepy, honestly. Weird, the whole thing.
I'm sure it was, said Strike. Well, there's just one more thing I wanted to ask, and then I'm done. My partner managed to track down Paul Satchwell.
Oh?
Said Janice, with no sign of embarrassment or discomfort.
Right. That was Margot's old boyfriend, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, we were surprised to find out you knew each other.
Janice looked at him blankly.
What?
That you knew each other, Strike repeated.
Me and Paul Satchwell,
said Janice with a little laugh.
I've never even met the man.
Really? Said Strike, watching her closely. When he heard you told us about the sighting of Margot in Leamington Spa, he got quite angry. He said words to the effect, Strike read off his notebook, that you were trying to cause trouble for him.
There was a long silence. A frown line appeared between Janice's round blue eyes,
At last she said,
"Did he mention me by name?"
"No," said Strike. "As a matter of fact, he seemed to have forgotten it. He just remembered you as the nurse. He also told Robin that you and Margot didn't like each other."
"He said Margot didn't like me?"
said Janice, with the emphasis on the last word. "I'm afraid so," said Strike, watching her.
"But, no, sorry, that's not right," said Janice. "We used to get on great. Other than that one time with Kevin his tummy. All right, I did get shirty with her then, but I knew she meant it kindly. She thought she was doing me a favour, examining him. I took offence because, well, you do get a bit defensive as a mother if you think another woman's judging you for not taking care of your kids properly. I was on my own with Kevin. You just feel it more when you're on your own."
"So why," Strike asked, "would Satchwell say he knew you and that you wanted to get him into trouble?" The silence that followed was broken by the sound of a train passing beyond the hedge. A great rushing rumble built and subsided, and the quiet of the sitting room closed like a bubble in its wake, holding the detective and the nurse in suspension as they looked at each other.
"I think you already know," said Janice at last.
"Know what?"
"Don't give me that. All them things you've solved. You're not a stupid man. I think you already know, and all this is to try and scare me into telling you."
"I'm certainly not trying to scare—"
"I know you didn't like her," said Janice abruptly. "Irene, don't bother pretending. I know she annoyed you. If I couldn't read people, I wouldn't have been any good at my job, going in and out of strangers' houses all the time, would I? And I was very good at my job," said Janice,
and somehow the remark didn't seem arrogant.
"Listen, you saw Irene in one of her show-off moods. She was so excited to meet you. She put on a big act. It's not easy for women living alone when they're used to company, you know. Even me, coming back from Dubai, it's been a readjustment. You get used to having family around you, and then you're back in the empty house again, alone. Me, I don't mind me own company, but Irene hates it." "She's been a very good friend to me, Irene," said Janice, with a kind of quiet ferocity. "Very kind. She helped me out financially after Larry died, back when I had nothing. I've always been welcome in her house. We're company for each other. We go back a long way. So she might have a few airs and graces, so what? So are plenty of people."
There was another brief pause.
"Wait there," said Janice firmly. "I need to make a phone call."
She got up and left the room. Strike waited. Beyond the neck curtains, the sun suddenly slid out from behind a bullet-coloured cloud and turned the glass Cinderella coach on the mantelpiece neon bright. Janice reappeared with a mobile in her hand.
"She's not picking up," she said, looking perturbed.
She sat back down on the sofa. There was another pause.
"Fine,"
said Janice at last, as though Strike had harangued her into speech.
"It wasn't me who knew Satchwell. It was Irene. But don't you go thinking she's done anything she shouldn't have. I mean, not in a criminal sense. It worried her like hell after. I was worried for her." "Oh, God," said Janice.
She took a deep breath, then said,
"All right, well, she was engaged to Eddie at the time. Eddie was a lot older than Irene. He worshipped the ground she walked on, and she loved him too, she did," said Janice,
though Strike hadn't contradicted her.
"And she was really jealous if Eddie so much as looked at anyone else. But she always liked a drink and a flirt, Irene. It was harmless, mostly harmless. That bloke Satchwell had a band, didn't he?"
"That's right," said Strike.
"Yeah, well, Irene saw him play at some pub. I wasn't with her the night she met Satchwell. I never knew a thing about it till after Margot had gone missing. So, she watched Satchwell and, well, she fancied him. And after the band had finished, she sees Satchwell come into the bar, and he goes right to the back of the room to Margot, who's standing there in the corner, in her raincoat. Irene thought Satchwell must have seen her from the stage. Irene hadn't spotted Margot before, because she was up the front with her friends. Anyway, she watched them, and Satchwell and Margot had a short chat. Really short, Irene said, and it looked like it turned into an argument. and then Irene reckoned Margot spotted her, and that's when Margot walked out. So then Irene goes up to that Satchwell and tells him she loved the band and everything, and, well, one thing led to another, and, yeah.
Why would Satchwell think she was a nurse? Asked Strike. Janice grimaced.
Well, to tell you the truth, that's what the silly girl used to tell blokes she was when they was chatting her up. She used to pretend to be a nurse because the fellas liked it. As long as they knew naff all about medical stuff, she managed to fool them, because she'd heard the names of drugs and all that at work, though she got most of them wrong. God love her, said Janice, with a small eye roll.
So this was a one-night stand, or...
No, it was a 2-3-week thing, but it didn't last. Margot disappearing, well, that put the kibosh on it, you can imagine. But for a couple of weeks there, Irene was... infatuated, I suppose you'd say. She did love Eddie, you know. It was a bit of a feather in her cap to have this older man, Eddie, successful business and everything, wanting to marry her, but... It's funny, isn't it? Said Janice, quietly. We're all animals, when you take everything else away. She totally lost her head over Paul Satchwell, just for a few weeks, trying to see him as much as she could, sneaking around. I bet she scared the life out of him, actually. Said Janice soberly, because from what she told me later, I think he only took her to bed to spite Margot. Margot was who he really wanted, and Irene realised that too late. She'd been used.
So the story of Irene's sore tooth, said Strike, which then became the story of a shopping trip.
Yeah, said Janice quietly. She was with Satchwell that afternoon. She took the receipt off her sister to use with the police. I never knew till afterwards. I had her in floods of tears in my flat, pouring her heart out. Well, who else could she tell? Not Eddie or her parents. She was terrified of it coming out and losing Eddie. She'd woken up by then. All she wanted was Eddie, and she was scared he'd drop her if he found out about Satchwell. See, Satchwell as good as told Irene the last time they met. He was using her to get back at Margot. He'd been angry at Margot for saying she'd only come to watch the band out of curiosity and for getting shirty when he tried to persuade her to go back to his flat. He gave her that little wooden Viking thing, you know. He had it on him, hoping she'd turn up, and I think he thought she'd just melt or something when he did that, and that'd be the end of Roy. Like that's all it takes, to walk out on a kid in a marriage, a little wooden doll. He said some nasty stuff about Margot to Irene. Prick tease was the least of it. Anyway, after Margot went missing and the police got called in, Satchwell rings Irene up and says not to mention anything he'd said about being angry at Margot, and she begged him never to tell anyone about the both of them, and that's how they left it. And I was the only one who knew, and I kept me mouth shut too, because, well, that's what you do when it's a friend, isn't it?
So when Charlie Ramage said he'd seen Margot in Leamington Spa, said Strike, were you aware?
That's where Satchwell came from. Not then I wasn't. Not when Charlie first told me. But not long after, there was a news story about some old geezer in Leamington Spa what had put up a sign in his front garden. Whites United Against Coloured Invasion, or some such horrible thing. Me and Larry was out for dinner with Eddie and Irene, and Eddie's talking about this old racist in the news. And then, when Irene and I went to the loo, she says to me, Leamington Spa, that's where Paul Satchwell was from. She hadn't mentioned him to me in ages. I won't lie, it gave me a proper uncomfortable feeling, her telling me that, because I thought, oh my God, what if Charlie really did see Margot? What if Margot ran off to be with her ex? But then I thought, hang on, though. If Margot only went as far as Leamington Spa, how come she hasn't never been seen since? I mean, it's hardly Timbuktu, is it?
No, said Strike, it isn't. And is all that Irene's ever told you about Margot and Satchwell?
It's enough, innit? Said Janice. Her pink and white complexion seemed more faded than when Strike had arrived, the veins beneath her eyes darker. Look, don't give Irene a hard time, please. She don't seem it, but she's soft under all that silly stuff. She worries, you know.
I can't see why I'd have to give her a hard time, said Strike. Well, you've been very helpful, Mrs. Beatty, thank you. That clears up quite a few points for me.
Janice slumped backwards on the sofa, frowning at Strike.
You smoke, don't you?
She said abruptly.
I can smell it off you. Didn't they stop you smoking after you had that amputation?
They tried, said Strike.
Very bad for you, she said. Won't help with your mobility, either, as you get older. Bad for your circulation and your skin. You should quit.
I know I should, said Strike, smiling at her as he returned his notebook to his pocket.
Hmm, said Janice, her eyes narrowed. Happened to be in the area. My Aunt Fanny.
Chapter 51. Never think that so that monster can be mastered or destroyed. He is not, he is not such a foe as steel can wound or strength can overthrow. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. The domed turrets of the Tower of London rose behind the wall of dirty yellow brick, but Robin had no attention to spare for ancient landmarks. Not only was the meeting she'd set up without Strike's knowledge supposed to start in 30 minutes' time, she was miles from where she'd expected to be at 1 o'clock, and completely unfamiliar with this part of London. She ran with her mobile in her hand, glancing intermittently at the map on its screen. Within a few paces, the phone rang. Seeing that it was Strike, she answered the call.
"Oi, just seen Janice."
"Oh, good," said Robin, trying not to pant as she scanned her surroundings for either a tube sign or a taxi. "Anything interesting?"
"Plenty," said Strike,
who was strolling back along Nightingale Grove. Notwithstanding his recent exchange with the nurse, he just lit a Benson and Hedges. As he walked into the cool breeze, the smoke was snatched from his lips every time he exhaled.
"Where are you at the moment?"
"Tower Bridge Road," said Robin, still running, still looking around in vain for a tube sign.
"Thought you were on shift as boss this morning."
"I was," said Robin. It was probably best that Strike knew immediately what had just happened. "I've just left him on Tower Bridge with Barclay."
"When you say with Barclay..."
"They might be talking by now, I don't know," said Robin. Unable to talk normally while jogging, she slowed to a fast walk.
"Cormoran, SB looked as though he was thinking of jumping."
"Off Tower Bridge?" asked Strike, surprised.
"Why not Tower Bridge?" said Robin, as she rounded a corner onto a busy junction. "It was the nearest accessible high structure."
"But his office isn't anywhere near."
"He got off at Monument as usual, but he didn't go into work. He looked up at the office for a bit, then walked away. I thought he was just stretching his legs. But then he headed out onto Tower Bridge and stood there, staring down at the water." Robin had spent 40 anxious minutes watching SB stare down at the cement-coloured river below, his briefcase hanging limply by his side, while traffic rumbled along the bridge behind him. She doubted that Strike could imagine how nerve-wracking she'd found the wait for Barclay to come and relieve her. There was still no sign of a tube station. Robin broke into a jog again.
"I thought of approaching him," she said, "but I was worried I'd startle him into jumping. You know how big he is. I couldn't have held him back."
"You really think he was..."
"Yes," said Robin, trying not to sound triumphant. She just caught sight of a circular red tube sign through a break in the traffic and started running.
"He looked utterly hopeless."
"Are you running?" asked Strike,
who could now hear her feet hitting the ground, even over the growl of traffic.
"Yes," said Robin, and then, "I'm late for a dental appointment."
She'd regretted not coming up with a solid reason earlier for not being able to interview Janice Beatty, and had decided on this story, should Strike ask again.
"Ah," said Strike, "right.
Anyway," Robin said, weaving around passers-by, "Barclay arrived to take over. He agreed SB looked like he was thinking of jumping, and he said..."
She was developing a stitch in her side now.
"Said he'd go and try and talk to him, and that's when I left. At least Barclay's big enough to hold him back if he tries anything,"
she finished breathlessly.
"But it also means SB will recognise Barclay in future," Strike pointed out.
"Well, yeah, I know that," said Robin,
slowing to a walk again as she was almost at the underground steps, and massaging the stitch in her side.
"But given that we thought he might be about to kill himself..."
"Understood," said Strike.
who had paused in the shadow of Hithergreen Station to finish his cigarette.
"Just thinking logistics. Course, if we're lucky, he might spill the beans to Barclay about what shift he's got on him. Desperate men are sometimes willing to..."
"Comorin, I'm going to have to go," said Robin, who'd reached the underground entrance. "I'll see you back at the office after my appointment, and you can fill me in about Janice."
"Right you are," said Strike. "Hope it doesn't hurt."
"What doesn't hurt?" "Oh, the dentist. No, it's just a checkup," said Robin.
Really convincing, Robin, she thought, angry at herself, as she shoved her mobile back into her pocket and ran down the steps into the underground. Once on the train, she stripped off her jacket because she was sweating from running and neatened her hair with the aid of her reflection in the dirty dark window opposite her. Between SB and his possible suicidal ideation, lying to Strike, her feeble cover story, and the potential risks of the meeting she was about to have, she felt jittery. There'd been another occasion, a couple of years previously, when Robin had chosen to pursue a line of inquiry while keeping it secret from Strike. It had resulted in Strike sacking her.
"This is different," she tried to reassure herself, smoothing sweaty strands of hair off her forehead. "He won't mind, as long as it works. It's what he wants, too."
She emerged at Tottenham Court Road Station 20 minutes later and hurried with her jacket over her shoulder into the heart of Soho. Only when she was approaching the Star Cafe and saw the sign over the door did she register the coincidence of the name. Trying not to think about asteroids, horoscopes, or omens, Robin entered the cafe, where round wooden tables stood on a red brick floor. The walls were decorated with old-fashioned tin signs, one of which was advertising Robin cigarettes. Directly beneath this, perhaps deliberately, sat an old man wearing a black windcheater, his face ruddy with broken veins, and his thick grey hair oiled into a quiff that had the appearance of not having changed since the '50s. A walking stick was propped against the wall beside him. On his other side sat a teenage girl with long neon yellow hair who was texting on her phone and didn't look up until Robin had approached their table.
"Mr. Tucker," said Robin.
"Yeah?"
said the man hoarsely, revealing crooked brown teeth.
"Miss Ellicott?"
"Robin," she said, smiling as they shook hands.
"This is my granddaughter, Lauren," said Tucker.
"Hiya,"
said Lauren, glancing up from her phone, then back down again.
"I'll just get myself a coffee," said Robin. "Can I buy either of you anything?"
They declined. While Robin bought herself a flat white, she sensed the eyes of the old man on her. During their only previous conversation, which had been by phone, Brian Tucker had talked for a quarter of an hour without pause about the disappearance of his eldest daughter, Louise, in 1972, and his lifelong quest to prove that Dennis Creed had murdered her. Roy Phipps had called Tucker half insane. While Robin wouldn't have gone that far on the evidence to date, there was no doubt that he seemed utterly consumed by Creed and with his quest for justice. When Robin returned to the Tucker's table and sat down with her coffee, Lauren put her phone away. Her long neon extensions, the unicorn tattoo on her forearm, her blatantly false eyelashes and her chipped nail varnish all stood in contrast to the innocent, dimpled face just discernible beneath her aggressively applied contouring.
"I came to help Grandad," she told Robin. "He doesn't walk so well these days."
"She's a good girl," said Tucker. "Very good girl."
"Well, thanks very much for meeting me," Robin told both of them. "I really appreciate it."
Close to, Tucker's swollen nose had a strawberry-like appearance, flecked as it was with blackheads.
"No, I appreciate it, Miss Ellicott," he said in his low, hoarse voice. "I think they're really going to let it happen this time, I do. And like I said on the phone, if they don't, I'm ready to break into the television studio."
"Well," said Robin, "hopefully we won't need to do anything that drass."
"And I've told them that, and it's shaking them up."
"Well, that and your contact nudging the Ministry of Justice,"
he conceded, gazing at Robin through small, bloodshot eyes.
"Mind you, I'm starting to think I should have threatened them with the press years ago. You don't get anywhere with these people playing by the rules. They just fob you off with their bureaucracy and their so-called expert opinions."
"I can only imagine how difficult it's been for you," said Robin. "But given that we might be in with a chance to interview him, we don't want to do anything
I'll have justice for Louise if it kills me, said Tucker. Let them arrest me. It would just mean more publicity.
But we wouldn't want... She don't want you to do nothing silly, Grandad, said Laura. She don't want you to mess things up.
No, I won't,
said Tucker. His eyes were small, flecked and almost colourless, set in pouches of purple.
But this might be our one and only chance, so it must be done in the right way, and by the right interrogator.
Is he not coming? Said Lauren. Cormor and Strike. Grandad said he might be coming. No, said Robin. And seeing the Tucker's face fall, she added quickly, He's on another case just now, but anything you'd say to Cormoran you can say to me as his part.
It's got to be him who interviews Creed, Tucker said. Not you. No, love, you don't, said Tucker firmly. This has been my whole life. I understand Creed better than any of the morons who've written books about him. I've studied him. He's been cut off from any kind of attention for years now. Your boss is a famous man. Creed'll want to meet him. Creed'll think he's cleverer, of course he will. He'll want to beat your boss, want to come out of it on top. But the temptation of seeing his name in the papers again, he's always thrived on the publicity. I think he'll be ready to talk, as long as your boss can make him believe it's worth his while. He's kosher, your boss, is he?
Under almost any other circumstances, Robin would have said, He's actually my partner. But today, understanding what she was being asked, she said, Yes, he's kosher.
Yeah, I thought he seemed it. I thought so, said Brian Tucker. When your contact got in touch, I went online. I looked it all up. Impressive what he's done. He doesn't give interviews, does he?
No, said Robin.
I like that,
said Tucker, nodding.
In it for the right reasons. But the name's known now. And that'll appeal to Creed, and so will the fact your boss has had contact with famous people. Creed likes all that. I've told the Ministry of Justice, and I told your contact, I want this Strike to do it. I don't want the police interviewing him. They've had their go, and we all know how well that went. And no more bloody psychiatrists, thinking they're so smart and they can't even agree on whether the bastard's sane or not. I know Creed. I understand Creed. I've made a lifelong study of his psychology. I was there every day in court during the trial. They didn't ask him about Lou in court, not by name. But he made eye contact with me plenty of times. He'll have recognised me. He'll have known who I was because Lou was my spitting image. When they asked him in court about the jewellery, you know, about the pendant, Lou's pendant.
Yes, said Robin.
She got it a couple of days before she disappeared. Showed it to her sister Liz, Lauren's mother, didn't she?
He asked Lauren, who nodded.
A butterfly on a chain, nothing expensive. And because it was mass-produced, the police said it could have been anyone's. Liz remembered the pendant differently. That's what threw the police off. She wasn't sure at first that it was Lou's, but she admitted she only saw it briefly. And when they mentioned the jewellery, Creed looked straight at me. He knew who I was. Lou was my spit image, repeated Tucker. You know his explanation for having a stash of jewellery under the floorboards?
Yes, said Robin. He said he'd bought it because he liked to cross-dress.
That he bought it, said Tucker, talking over Robin, to dress up in.
Mr. Tucker, you said on the phone, Lou nicked it from that shop they all used to go to.
What was it?
Bieber, said Lauren.
Bieber, said Tucker. 2 days before she disappeared, she played truant, and that evening she showed Lauren's mum, Liz, what she'd stolen. She was a handful, Lou. Didn't get on with my second wife. The girl's mum died when Lou was 10. It affected Lou the worst, more than the other two. She never liked my second wife.
He told Robin all of this on the phone, but still she nodded sympathetically.
My wife had a row with Lou the morning before she disappeared, and Lou bunked off school again. We didn't realise until she didn't come home that night. Rang round all her friends. None of them had seen her, so we called the cops. We found out later one of her friends had lied. she'd smuggled Lou upstairs and not told her parents. Lou was spotted 3 times next day, still in her school uniform. Last known sighting was outside a laundrette in Kentish Town. She asked some geezer for a light. We knew she'd started smoking. That was partly what she railed with my wife about. Creed picked up Vera Kenny in Kentish Town too, said Tucker, hoarsely. In 1970, right after he'd moved into the place by Paradise Park. Vera was the first woman he took back to that basement. He chained them up, you know, and kept them alive while he...
Grandad, said Lauren plaintively. Don't.
No,
Tucker muttered, dipping his head.
Sorry, love.
Mr. Tucker, said Robin, seizing her chance, you said on the phone you had information about Margot Bamber and nobody else knows.
Yeah,
said Tucker, groping inside his wind cheater for a wad of folded papers, which he unfolded with shaking hands.
This top one I got through a warder at Wakefield back in 79. I used to hang around there every weekend in the late 70s, watch them all coming in and out. Found out where they liked to drink and everything. Anyway, this particular warder, I won't say his name, but we got chummy. Creed was on a high security wing in a single cell, because all the other cons wanted to take a pop at him. One geezer nearly took out Creed's eye in 82, stole a spoon from the canteen and sharpened the handle to a point in his cell. Tried to stab Creed through the eyeball. Just missed because Creed dodged. My mate told me he'd screamed like a little girl, said Tucker, with relish. Anyway, I sent them my mate. I said, anything you can find out, anything you can tell me. Things Creed's saying, hints he gives, you know. I paid him for it. He could have lost his job if anyone had found out. And my mate got hold of this and smuggled it out to me. I've never been able to admit to having it because both of us would be in trouble if it got out. But I called up Margot Bamber's husband. What was his name? Roy Phipps. Roy Phipps, yeah. I said, I've got a bit of Creed's writing here you're going to want to see. It proves he killed your wife.
A contemptuous smile revealed Tucker's toffee-brown teeth again.
But he didn't want to know, said Tucker. Phipps thought I was a crank. A year after I called him, I read in the paper he'd married the nanny. Creed did Dr. Phipps a good turn, it seems. Grandad,
said Lauren, shocked.
All right, muttered Tucker. I never liked that doctor. He could have done us a lot of good if he wanted to. Hospital consultant. He was the kind of man the Home Secretary would have listened to. We could have kept up the pressure if he'd helped us, but he wasn't interested. And when I saw he was off with a nanny, I thought, oh, right, everything's explained.
Could I... Robin began, gesturing towards the paper Tucker was still holding flat to the table, but he ignored her.
So it was just me and Jerry for years, said Tucker. Jerry Wolfson, Cara's brother. You know who that is,
he shot at Robin. Yes, the nightclub hostess.
Nightclub hostess, hooker on the side and a drug habit as well. Jerry had no illusions about her. He wasn't naive. But it was still his sister. She raised him after their mother left. Cara was all the family he had. February 1973, 3 months after my Lou, Cara disappeared as well. Left her club in Soho in the early hours of the morning. Another girl left at exactly the same time. It wasn't far from here, as a matter of fact, said Tucker, pointing out of the door. The two girls go different ways up the street. The friend looks back and sees Cara bending down and talking to a van driver at the end of the road. The friend assumed that Cara knew the driver. She walks off. Cara's never seen again. Jerry spoke to all Cara's friends at the club after, but nobody knew anything. There was a rumour going round after Cara disappeared that she'd been a police informer. That club was run by a couple of gangland figures. Suited them to say she was an informer, see? Scared the other girls into keeping stum about anything they'd seen or heard in the club. But Jerry never believed Cara was a snitch. He thought it was the Essex Butcher from the start. The van was the giveaway. So we joined forces. He tried to get permission to visit Creed, same as me, but the authorities wouldn't let us. Jerry gave up in the end. Drank himself to death. Something like this happens to someone you love, it marks you. You can't get out from under it. The weight of it crushes some people. My marriage broke up. My other two daughters didn't speak to me for years. Wanted me to stop going on about Lou. Stop talking about Creed. Pretend it never... That's not fair, Grandad, said Lauren sternly. Yeah, all right, mumbled Tucker. All right, I grant you. Lauren's mum, she's come round lately. I said to Liz, think of all the time I should have spent with Lou, like I've spent with you and Lisa. Add it all up, family meals and holidays, helping her with her homework, telling her to clean her room, arguing with her. My God, she could be bolshy. Watching her graduate, I expect, because she was clever, Lou, even if she did get in trouble at school with all the bunking off. I said to Liz, I never got to walk her up the aisle, did I? Never got to visit her in hospital when her kids were born. Add up all the time I would have given her if she'd lived. Tucker faltered. Lauren put a plump hand over her grandfather's, which had swollen purple joints. Add all that time together, Tucker croaked. His eyes filled me with tears. And that's what I owe her, to find out what happened to her. That's all I'm doing, giving her a due.
Robin felt tears prickle behind her own eyelids.
I'm so sorry, she said quietly.
Yeah, well, said Tucker,
wiping his eyes and nose roughly on the sleeve of his windcheater. He now took the top sheet of writing and thrust it at Robin.
There you are. That shows you what we're up against.
Robin took the paper, on which was written two short paragraphs, in clear, slanting writing, every letter separate and distinct, and began to read. She attempts to control through words and sometimes with flattery. Tells me how clever I am, then talks about treatment. The strategy is laughably transparent. Her qualifications and her training are, compared to my self-knowledge, my self-awareness, the flicker of a damp match beside the light of the sun. She promises a diagnosis of madness will mean gentler treatment for me. This she tells me between screams as I whip her face and breasts. Bleeding, she begs me to see that she could be of use to me, would testify for me. Her arrogance and her thirst for dominance have been fanned by the societal approval she gained from the position of doctor. Even chained, she believes herself superior. This belief will be corrected.
You see, said Tucker in a fierce whisper, he had Margot Bamborough chained in his basement. He's enjoying writing about it, reliving it. But the psychiatrists didn't think it was an admission. They reckon Creed was just turning out these bits of writing to try and draw more attention to himself. They said it was all a game to try and get more interviews, because he liked pitting his wits against the police and reading about himself in the press, seeing himself on the news. They said that was just a bit of fantasy, and that taking it seriously would give Creed what he wanted, because talking about it would turn him on.
Gross, said Lauren, under her breath. But my Walder mate said, because, you know, there was three women they thought Creed had done whose bodies were never found. My Lou, Cara Wolfson, and Margot Bamborough. And my Walder mate said, it was the doctor he really liked being asked about. Creed likes high-status people, see. He thinks he could have been the boss of some multinational, or some professor or something, if he hadn't have turned to killing. My mate told me all this. He said, Creed sees himself on that sort of level, you know. Just in a different field.
Robin said nothing. The impact of what she'd just read wasn't easily dispelled. Margot Bamborough had become real to Robin, and she'd just been forced to imagine her, brutalized and bleeding, attempting to persuade a psychopath to spare her life.
Creed got transferred to Belmarsh in 83, Tucker continued,
patting the papers still laid in front of him, and Robin forced herself to concentrate.
And they started drugging him so he couldn't get a, you know, couldn't maintain. And that's when I got permission to write to him, and have him write back to me. Ever since he was convicted, I've been lobbying the authorities to let me question him directly, and let him write back. I wore them down.